Hello and welcome to episode 111 of Linux Dev Time. I'm Joe.
I'm Monolith.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Andy.
Good to talk to you all again. Previously, we talked about soft skills, the stuff that you need to know as well as writing code. And we've talked plenty of times about the writing code aspect of being a dev. But there is kind of an in-between, the kind of code adjacent stuff that you do. For example, Andy, you often write code that isn't the code that you're supposed to be writing.
Don't tell anyone.
I do get distracted with side projects, and sometimes I can justify them and sometimes I can't. The thing that comes to mind that I have a really strong memory of, and I think it's more of a memory of what it's like to work in a large corporate than it is about yak shaving. But I remember specifically going to my boss and saying, look, I need to figure out how we test this bit of code because it's really hairy and it's full of bugs and we just haven't got a decent way of testing it. And I remember my boss saying to me, yeah, we should do that, but we haven't got time to do it. So I went off and did it. And then that was the thing at my end of year review where it was like, you know, that's the thing that really gets you a good review this year. You took the initiative and went and did that thing. What I did, by the way, speaking of like it being a bit of a weird side project, is I wrote a like mini programming language to describe the problem space. Not a very complicated one, but like, you know, just something that perfectly described the inputs to this test that I wanted and the output that I expected, because it was really hard to express that in code. You know, it's pages and pages of code to say you've got this object. So I just made a nice simple language to describe that. But yeah, going to your boss and saying, I just need to write one little programming language is probably not going to get you anywhere.
I'm curious, Andy, though, like, you don't have to answer this, but was that on paid time that you did that? Because maybe your boss was saying like, hey, yeah, that would be great if you did that. Just we can't bill for that or something along those lines.
My time wasn't being directly billed to a customer. I think that would be a bit different, but it certainly was in work time. I have a bit of a policy of when I'm not on work time, I'm doing stuff that's not in any way related to work.
Is that true, though? Because you make these videos about Rust, and that's not directly related to work, but it kind of is.
It's definitely helped my work to learn Rust, which I've done through doing this stuff. So I'm not saying it can never in any way overlap, but if at any moment I think to myself, oh, I should just finish off this thing for work, or what would really help me in my work is if I had this extra tool, then there's a little part of my brain that goes, nope, do that on work time.
I wonder if that's why a lot of companies too will ask, like, hey, what do you do for hobbies? What do you do for fun? Because a lot of developers like doing their job also for fun, or at least it's adjacent, right? Because it does make you better as a developer to be working on some of those same like problem space ideas and similar tasks in your spare time. So I can understand why a company might be like, hey, if you like doing that for fun, that's awesome. We want those kind of people that are also going to make themselves better at the thing they're doing when we're not paying them to do so.
We want people who literally never leave the room that they're in.
But Amleth, for example, you read a lot of blog posts and documentation about programming languages in your spare time, don't you?
Yeah, and I enjoy doing that. And I know it is professional development to some extent, but that I enjoy it so much almost makes it feel less like work, and it feels like I should be doing something more productive, such as writing code.
But there has to be more than just writing code, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're just never going to progress in your career. You're never going to progress as a developer if all you do is just write code all day. You need to go off and do experiments, read blog posts, watch videos, read books, whatever it is that inspires you and teaches you a new thing.
Yeah, I think it's all about expanding your horizon, expanding your experience. And that's what a lot of people say about like learning a new language or a new paradigm. It teaches your brain to think in a whole new way about the problems that you might be working on at work. And I think some of those, reading a blog post, listening to a podcast, watching some videos, like all of those things can help expand the way you think about a particular problem. So while just endlessly watching videos that are absolutely unrelated to anything you're doing, that might be a stretch, but as long as they're in the same realm, i.e. development, I think that's a big win because it just expands the way you think about things.
Yeah, I also think that applies to creative stuff, like, you know, not just reading stuff, but also writing blogs and things like that. You know, I think all of that contributes.
Well, you make these videos, right, Andy? Mm-hmm. And you mentioned to us off air that you wrote Rust in Rust. You've got to tell us about this.
I'm starting a new video series where I'm writing like a miniature version of Rust in Rust. I'm not planning to like make it like a full version of Rust, but I'm writing a little interpreter. So it'll be like, you know, the way Python, you can just knock up a little Python script and you'll be able to run it. Well, this will be like that, but the syntax that you use will be Rust-like syntax because I like the way Rust does types and stuff like that. So that's my plan. So I've been making little videos that maybe 20 minutes long of, you know, in the first video, you could put in the number 3 and it would print out a thing saying, I've recognized that you put in the number 3, you know, and then gradually build it up. So now I've got to the point where you can add two numbers together and you get the answer out at the end. So that's pretty exciting.
And there's not any specific point to this. One might even argue that it is pointless, but it's not pointless, right? It is part of your professional development.
It's purely for fun. So the reason I've become very productive suddenly and made like 7 of these videos in the last couple of days is because I just really enjoyed it. And I got to the end of my series, like teaching how to code in Rust. And that felt a little bit like it was really good, but it felt a little bit like I was doing something proper. So I was like, right, now I'm going to do something just silly.
Well, it's like you've talked about before, writing, is it Tetris or no, Snake. You write Snake in every language or whatever.
Yeah. I was actually discussing how to write Snake in the pattern matching sub language of Rust today. I'm wondering whether you could do that, but that would really be good professional development.
But even throughout some of these little tasks, like there'll be little side things that you pick up, like, I don't know, maybe you're parsing some type of file or you're trying to figure out how to swap some stuff around in memory, whatever it happens to be, those little side tasks, at least for me, all the time pop up in regular work later on, totally unrelated to whatever silly task I was doing at the time. But it's all those like little side things or like new little libraries you learn about or like all of those things really do pay off later on.
I have a tiny little side project that they let me do occasionally at work, which is writing a little bot, a matrix bot, because I work on matrix. And I've been hacking away on that for a year or two. And actually, I've been live streaming some of what I was doing. And I thought I was just getting to play around with something and work was paying me for this time. I felt good about it. And then the next thing I knew, the stuff that I'd learned from doing that was absolutely critical to a task that I was doing. And it was like, okay, this stuff does actually work out pretty well. The other part that I find out about this is that little projects like that really motivate me. So I get much better at getting my normal work done if I've spent a little bit of time working on something more fun like that. It actually, it buoys me up and I go faster.
Yeah, I think everybody's a little bit different, but that might be one of those cases where, you know, some people it's forcing yourself to stand up and go take a walk or whatever. But if you can find out what those things are for your people, it can be really helpful to say like, hey, let's give everybody some 20% time where, you know, spend a little bit of your time during your day working on a task. Maybe it's not directly related to work or whatever, but it's something to get your mind going and something you enjoy. And it really can get you into the mood or the mind space to develop. And that can be very, very beneficial to a team.
Especially if some of your work time is spent being frustrated that you're not getting to write code because there's all this other stuff you have to do. So you can kind of counteract that sense of frustration.
I started a project called Willow. It tracks software releases across arbitrary forges like GitHub and Gitty and whatnot. That started off as a hobby thing on the side for fun to explore a solution to a problem I was having. And it is in the process of becoming a work thing, and I'm going to be paid to work on it.
Amazing.
Yeah, it is really cool.
That's the dream.
I also had this idea to build that geocoding Android app I talked about in some previous episode. That had me learning Kotlin and working with Go and Braintree and a bunch of stuff. And that started off as an idea for a hobby thing, and it's also a work thing, and we're going to run it as a service to have an additional revenue stream for the co-op.
So what exactly does it do then?
You open the app. There's a search bar at the top. You type in the name of a place you're looking for. For example, bar near road near you, open at whatever time. And then it just has a list of results. And then you can share that place's name, address, coordinates, and open location code to a friend. And open location code is like a, it compresses geo coordinates. So it's a shorter, more friendly string than a bunch of numbers. And you can just open that location in whatever navigation app you like, such as Organic Maps or OSM and anything like that. But the results come from Google. So you're searching for business names that wouldn't normally be in OpenStreetMaps, for example.
Why can't you just use Google Maps for that?
Because I don't like Google.
You don't like Google, so you just use them through the back door.
Yeah.
So it's Google Maps for people who hate Google.
Mm-hmm. And it only searches for and displays results. It doesn't do any navigation itself. It doesn't have any map tiles in the app. It's only for opening results from Google Maps in some other application.
And therefore, it doesn't track you.
Exactly.
And this started as an itch you wanted to scratch. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that other people are interested in scratching that same itch then.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And you got to work in the like geospace field that in and of itself is a super complex subfield of programming. So even just getting exposed to things like map tiles and geo-coordinates and all these other things, like that's a pretty big thing that I don't know a lot of people that jump into on their own. That's awesome.
Okay. This episode is sponsored by 1Password. Imagine your company's security like the quad of a college campus. There are nice brick paths between the buildings. Those are company-owned devices, IT-approved apps, and managed employee identities. And then there are the paths people actually use, the shortcuts worn through the grass that are the actual straightest line from point A to B. Those are unmanaged devices, shadow IT apps, and non-employee identities like contractors. Most security tools only work on those happy brick paths, but a lot of security problems take place on the shortcuts. 1Password Extended Access Management is the first security solution that brings all these unmanaged devices, apps, and identities under your control. It ensures that every user credential is strong and protected, every device is known and healthy, and every app is visible. 1Password Extended Access Management solves the problems traditional IAM and MDM can't touch. It's security for the way we work today, and it's now generally available to companies with Okta and Microsoft Entra, and in beta for Google Workspace customers. So support the show and check it out at 1Password.com/LinuxDevTime. That's 1Password.com/LinuxDevTime. Quick bit of admin then. First of all, thank you everyone who supports us with PayPal and Patreon. We really do appreciate that. If you want to join those people, you can go to LinuxDevTime.com/support. And remember that for various amounts on Patreon, you can get an advert-free RSS feed that includes either just this show or all the shows in the Late Night Linux family. And you also get quite a lot of episodes a day or so early. And if you want to get in contact with us, you can email show@linuxdevtime.com. So what about resources for learning new stuff then? Have you got any recommendations?
Andy's videos on Rust.
Yeah, obviously. We've definitely got a link to that.
Just Andy's videos in general. They're all good.
This is my favorite episode.
As far as resources, I really like news aggregators. I mean, my favorite is Lobsters because it has the most civil discourse that I think I've seen. And there you get a good overview of a lot of relevant programming topics. So that's probably my favorite place to look because it kind of scans the internet. But there's also, I guess if we can name a particular individual, there's a Faster Than Lime series, which is a website. There's a podcast called Self-Directed Research or something. But that individual and the people that they collaborate with is pretty phenomenal. Also really good Fediverse follow.
Relatedly, more Rust resources. I really like John Jengset's Rust videos. They're awesome. Very in-depth.
Oh, I'd very much recommend those. Yes.
Why?
So this is a person that, from my understanding, either started with Rust on a research project building a database for their PhD, and then eventually became one of like the Tokyo developers. And it's just very, very deep in the asynchronous Rust series, but also just very deep into Rust in general. However, they make very, very detailed videos. They're very long videos usually, but he's also just a very good teacher. He'll diagram stuff out. They're very in-depth, very well thought out. It's a pleasure to watch his videos and content.
If you ever watch things on YouTube and get frustrated that they don't go deep enough, right, then you won't have that feeling with John Jengset's videos. Amelith, you have loads of links always coming up from you, so you must know some good places to find stuff.
Lobsters is a great place. That's Lobsters where the TLDs .rs. So lobste.rs. We can put a link in the show notes. Or even better, all of the RSS feeds I subscribe to are on secluded.site/feeds. So you can read through and look at all the sources and pick and choose what you like.
Or just get the OPML file and just dump it into an RSS reader and be overwhelmed.
Yes.
I need to get myself onto Lobsters. I just use Mastodon. I think there's too many different types of social media in the world. So I've just stuck with Mastodon, which has done me okay. But it sounds like maybe I should be on Lobsters.
Because Lobsters is kind of like Hacker News, but without the VC and stuff, right?
Yeah.
Without a lot of the nonsense, yes.
And you have to have an account to post, but you can read it without an account, right?
Correct.
Being able to post or comment requires an invitation from someone else who has an account already, but you can follow and read without an account.
Which is what most people want to do anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we've got too far into this resources conversation without mentioning paper books.
NoStarchPress.com. It's a wonderful source.
I know it's all just going to be Rust recommendations, but the Rust programming language, which is the semi-official book of Rust, is excellent. And paper is an excellent way to read it.
And John as well also has a book called Rust for Rustations, which is actually, it like goes a level deeper.
It goes 17 levels deeper.
That's probably true.
Yeah, some of that I understood.
Oddly enough, I've also found Manning has a lot of really good books. I really like their MEEP section, which is their early access program, I think is what it stands for. And a lot of these books, they're not complete. They're not finished yet, but you can kind of see the progress as they go along. And the topics are always good. The topics are always current. So I really enjoy their MEEP program.
The Missing README is a great specific book I'd recommend. They bill it as a guide for the new software engineer. It's got advice for new engineers, stories from people who have been programming for decades, and practical stuff that's not taught in schools and boot camps. Got a lot of really good information.
I really like the Python tutorial, which is just the default way. If you go to the Python website to try and learn Python, they'll send you to the Python tutorial. And it worked for me many years ago. I think it's really good.
What about communities?
There's a huge community for Go on Slack. They refer to it as the Gophers Slack. And there's projects have channels, different groups dedicated to different fields of programming with Go. Lots of good stuff in there too.
Yeah, there's a Rust one on Discord as well that's also really big, really good. There's lots of different topics in there. I think when it comes to development communities, at least the ones I've always seen, they've always been kind of centered around a particular language or a particular product. I haven't seen too many open just developer communities, at least in the sort of like near real-time chat, you know, Slack, Discord, IRC, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and also conferences tend to be language-focused. I have gone for years to a conference called ACCU, which used to stand for Association of C and C++ Users, but became just a more general programming conference with some C++ focus, but plenty of other stuff as well. And that was the closest I've found to a community that wasn't language-focused. Really awesome community.
I've gone to a few meetups as well. There was one that I used to attend, and it was specifically for Rust, but it was a great resource for just people in the local area that were interested in the same thing as I was. You know, we worked in various companies, and that was a great resource for a lot of years. So, I mean, I would recommend looking and seeing what meetups are in your area. And I'm sure it'll vary by location and by quality of the meetup organizer, but that can be a really good place because a lot of times they'll also have an online community as well to organize their meetups.
Why is it that it's often language specific then? Is it because each language is so different and the applications of it tend to be really quite different? Like someone who's writing Java and someone who's writing Rust are not necessarily going to have that much in common. Like you're both developers, but you're not necessarily going to be working on even similar types of software. Maybe Java and Rust are not the best examples there. Maybe Rust and say, you know, the JavaScript and React and those kind of developers are just doing two very different things.
Maybe, but I'm skeptical. As someone who loves to learn new languages and try and bring knowledge from one into another, I'm quite skeptical that actually there isn't a lot in common, that a lot that people could learn. And I wish the JavaScript community would learn from some of the other communities. But it's weird. I think languages are one of the things that people get excited about, right? So text editors is another. But people get really excited about languages. And then that kind of forms a community around that enthusiasm.
Excited or tribal?
Both.
Excitedly tribal, yeah.
I think it's that the questions that people end up talking about are sometimes very specific, like almost syntactic level things about a particular language. And that just kind of leads into, if someone's asking a very specific Erlang type question or talking about some sort of syntax in Erlang, I just probably wouldn't have a good answer for them. So it'd be harder for me to interact if we were talking more generally about what they're working on, maybe. But then even things that I can provide them may not be super applicable. However, I would say, like, for me, Lobsters have been kind of that language agnostic. It's not a, you know, real-time chat. I think they do have an IRC channel or something. But for me, it's been that place where people from all kinds of different languages will come in and display the link that they like or the topic that they like, and it spawns all kinds of great discussion.
I think it's a little bit like sports teams, right? You could get two people who support rival teams, and they wouldn't even speak to each other in the pub. But then what they sit down and talk to their friends about is going to sound very, very similar, right, between the two different groups. It's just that they happen to know the names of these players instead of those players or whatever.
Right, well, we'd better get out of here then. We'll be back in a couple of weeks, but until then, I've been Joe.
I've been Amalith.
I've been Kevin.
And I've been Andy.
See you later.